Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how normalizing ties with Assad could help strengthen the axis of resistance against Israel even further, which includes Iran and resistance groups like Lebanon's Hezbollah, all natural allies of Syria.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this years-long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fraud Hughes joins us. He's a journalist, author, and activist who joins us from Belfast. Also joining us, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst who joins us from Marseille.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Elijah Magnier, first over to you. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad meeting with Palestinian factions, which included Hamas in Damascus. This is said to be a very big deal. Why is it considered to be that?
Thank you for having me.
First of all, it is initiative by President Assad, who opened his arms to Hamas after the position of Hamas in 2011 against the government in Damascus joining the rebels and the Takfiri, thinking that it was possible to overthrow the regime in Damascus. That was a mistake, but Hamas returned to this mistake, and the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, the Hezbollah secretary general Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, both worked on the restoration of the relationship between Hamas and the Syrian president and government to make sure that what happened was a mistake and that Hamas recognized it, changed its policy, and understand that it was only the axis of the resistance that was helping the Palestinian people and group who are willing to recover their land, disregarding the useless Oslo agreement. This is why we see today Hamas in Damascus, after a heavy initiative that made by the members of the axis of the resistance, because it is no longer the time to look at the differences, but to look at what brings all these members of the axis together. Hamas is an important member of the axis of the resistance. It is returning now to the same axis with strength, particularly after the clashes with the Israelis, the sword of Jerusalem, the support to the Islamic Jihad in Palestine. And we've seen that the position of Hamas has changed radically. And now it is time for Hamas to return to Syria, that is also a very important member of the axis of the resistance, with a direct front with Palestine, because also Syria has another cause to recover the occupied Golan Heights from the Israeli occupiers.
What about the timing of this, Frahis, coming at this point?
Well, I think the timing is very significant. Having unity talks between the different resistance groups of Palestine. We're seeing a thawing out of relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We recently had the ceasefire in Yemen, which may have broken down, but still offers the chance of a peaceful settlement in Yemen. So what we could be witnessing is the re-recognition of Syria as a sovereign nation, as part of the Arab League, as a bulwark to the Zionist aggression that is the apartheid Israeli state. But having said all that, everyone is obviously going to welcome Hamas back to Damascus, welcome them back into the fold. But I must say, as someone who's been in Syria five times, I actually stayed in Latakia for 15 days on a convoy to Gaza in 2010, before the war on Syria began in 2011. I've always thought that Syria, the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab army, and the Syrian people have been very strong advocates and supporters of the Palestinian right for sovereignty and self-determination. And I feel very strongly that Hamas, when you consider Syria fought in two wars on behalf of the Palestinian cause, Syrian soldiers died and Syrian families were left without a father and without a brother and without sons in both those wars. I think it's really important in my mind that I felt that Hamas actually stuck a knife in the back of the Syrian government and the Syrian people when it left in 2011. And indeed, it was invited into Syria in 1999 when they were asked to leave Jordan. So Syria has always been there for the Palestinians. I am just saddened that Hamas was not there for the Syrian people in their hour of need.
Well, Elijah Magnier, what do you think will now happen when you have Hamas cementing its role within, as you mentioned, the axis of resistance at this point, which will strengthen that? Against its arch enemy, Israel. I mean, will this impact the way that each acts against the other, meaning the way that Hamas or the Palestinian factions act against Israel and vice versa?
Well, Hamas has been very active in Palestine in the last few years, and I think this time is very important, the return of Hamas to be operative in Syria, because it means if the Syrian people have seen more than 11 years of war, many of these Syrians are really eager to fight the Israelis because they have developed skills that are needed. And they will join the resistance because they have joined the axis of the resistance, many of them in Nobel Zahra and other cities in Syria, where they are armed with a stronger ideology. And that can support the Palestinian cause even further, particularly in a time when Iran is rising with its weapon, becoming completely independent and showing deterrence. Hezbollah is showing deterrence against the Israelis and imposing the demarcation line on the maritime border between Israel and Lebanon, and threatening the Israelis of any attack on its members in Syria. So we've seen the axis of the resistance taking complete different turn today by imposing a very strong deterrence against Israel. By having Hamas, this will increase the activity of the Palestinians, will bring all those Palestinians who are living in Damascus that had been offering a shelter to the Palestinians since they were expelled from their villages in 1949. And these Palestinians are looking forward to join also Hamas and to join the forces with all the Palestinian group who are willing to turn their back against all the deals that the Palestinian Authority is signing with Israel and agreeing with Israel, and they have opted the resistance. And now we've seen the new generation in Palestine that is uprising against the Israelis, having a society that is protecting them when everybody was thinking that the new generation will completely forget about the Palestinian cause, proving that it's completely different. So by joining the forces of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and other groups and the Democratic Palestinian Organization that are willing to continue the fight until they liberate their territory is something very positive to everybody who is supporting this cause.
Well, Fra Hughes, we have noticed that Syria is coming back into the fold and recently, almost with full force in a sense. I mean, we're looking at what has happened with Hamas, which is formalized now, this rapprochement. We're looking at how Jordan's King Abdullah also has signaled that, along with the United Arab Emirates. Can't forget how they embraced each other when that occurred, and then Bahrain reopening also its embassy, just like the UAE did. Several officials in several Arab states are pressing to actually reinstate Syria back into the Arab League, though that has to actually come about. And then more recently, there's been this talk about Turkey, of which the Turkish president said, the time has to be right, in so many words. Why do you think these shifts have happened when it comes to Syria?
Well, think what people have. A lot of people have done is maybe sat on the sidelines. A lot of the countries that you've mentioned withdrew their embassy staff, withdrew their political support for the government of Syria whenever this war on Syria began. It was portrayed as a rising of the people. That's actually how Hamas envisaged that in 2011. They welcomed the revolution from the people. But with time and with hindsight and with 2020 vision, we can all see that this was, although a lot of people said it at the very beginning, that this was regime change that was being fomented by Saudi Arabia and America and Israel, and latterly Turkey, because Turkey allowed the majority of the jihadists to move unhindered through Turkey and into Syria. And Turkey at this moment in time is actually occupying a large swathe of Syrian territory along the border. So I think that because the government and the people of Syria have stood strong in the face of this international war that has been waged upon them, that people have seen that the regime is now stronger than it was before. It is firmly embedded in place and has the support of the majority of Syrian people. It also has its comrades from the Republican Guard and from Hezbollah and from Russia. So there are three different organizations and two different countries that are standing shoulder to shoulder with the Syrian people against this Western-backed jihadist insurgency. So I think there's a rapprochement between Turkey and Russia. And, Syria is only Like, I love the people of Syria, but it's only a small piece in the wider jigsaw puzzle that is the geopolitical kind of ramifications in West Asia. So I think as Russia and Turkey grow closer, and perhaps Iran and Turkey might grow closer, then at some stage, I hope that the Turkish authorities and Erdogan will remove Turkish troops and allow the Syrian Arab army to protect the border of Turkey and the border of Syria with its own troops. So, you know, there's a wider context here. There's other things going on in the background. And I think that it's these kind of quiet, peaceful negotiations in the background that may eventually lead to Turkey withdrawing, I hope, and that America will then be forced to leave, and the terrorists in Idlib will be forced to leave too.
Well, the confusing part here, Elijah Magnier, which has been a big question mark, is the fact that you have, for example, the UAE formalizing itself again with Syria, but at the same time, it has also formalized its relationship with Israel. Turkey the same. If it were to go ahead with Syria, at the same time, just recently, it actually formalized itself back with Israel, and along with some of the other Arab countries. How would that work? Because you have some conflicting interests there, don't you?
Yes, in a way, yes. But we've seen the many Arab and Gulf states have normalized relationship with Israel, because first it was a demand from the Americans. Second, they had already a relationship with Israel under the table. However, the position of Hamas returning to Syria is showing that Syria is a heart of the Arab resistance against Israel. Secondly, is the normalization with Israel is not going to change anything, because the Palestinian realized that all the Arabs have normalized relationship with Israel, dropping completely the Arab cause. So for Syria to deal with these countries who have normalized relationship with Israel, it's a matter of state and business and relationship independently from the Palestinian cause. So one step and one position doesn't eliminate the other. However, the countries like the Emirates, like Qatar, like Bahrain, and also Saudi Arabia, that is flirting with Israel all the time, all these countries will realize that they have to acknowledge the position of Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, and the Palestinian willing to fight against Israel. And they can't keep away from Syria, because they think by having a relationship with Syria, perhaps they can push away Syria further from the axis of the resistance, which is a wishful thinking that is not going to happen because of the war everybody in the Gulf have invested in destroying Syria, that caused more than $400 to $600 billion as a destruction, and that needed to reconstruct the country. And this is something that President Assad and the Syrian population will never forget. However, when it deals with the from state to state and business and the reconstruction of the country, Syria has to make a choice to return to the Arab League, but doesn't mean that it's going to change its firm position in support of the axis of the resistance, of which it is a very strong member.
All right. So you have all this happening. And recently, we had another major event that took place for our Hughes, and that was, which was about a week ago, when Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, which included Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups. And they also agreed to actually hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. How important is that? And is it a coincidence that this has happened, and then now we're looking at what has happened with the Palestinian factions, including Hamas, going to Syria?
There's probably just the wider ramifications, again, within the region, that what we hear publicly and what we see with the reconciliation talks in hosted by Algeria. I mean, there are probably lots of other kind of communications between Iran and, say, Hamas, and between Damascus and Iran, and between the different groups that different people support, like the Qataris. So, I mean, there are domestic and there are ambassadorial kind of communications that are going on within the region. So it could just be what we're seeing optically and what we're hearing is just a solidification of everything coming together. Now, whether or not these unity talks will actually result in say, combined military operations on the ground will yet to be seen. But unity is strength, and the more people involved in the axis of resistance, the more groups, the more individuals, and the more countries, the stronger the combined response could be to any Israeli aggression. Since 1967, there hasn't really been any country in the Middle East who could stand up to the Israeli firepower, because Israeli firepower is really American and NATO firepower, because they supply the weapons, they supply the aircraft, they supply the helicopters, they supply the munitions. But the strength of Iran and the fact that Syria is still standing on its feet after facing over 100,000 jihadists who had come from possibly outside of the country in order to destroy the government and balkanize Syria. Syria is still standing. Iran is stronger than ever. The axis of resistance is having a palpable effect on the apartheid state of Israel. And if somehow the Palestinian factions can actually truly come together, and, you know, really they would need, through the elections, I hope that Abbas would no longer be in charge of the Palestinian Authority, which many Palestinians and many people outside of Palestine consider a collaborative Quisling organization. They have their cars and they have the trappings of government and they have money and homes and power and prestige. But that's all in the shadow of the Israeli government.
Well, at the Algiers meeting, there was a deep statement made to Elijah Magnier by Ismail Haniyeh, in which he said, quote, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." Do you think that that is an appropriate and applicable thing that he said? Is that truly within some kind of reach when he makes a statement like that?
Hamas has extended its hand to the Palestinian Authority, and not in the meeting in Algeria, but before that, a year or a couple of years or even more, asking for reconciliation and asking for a re-election of Mahmoud Abbas that has been in power for over 16 years, and asking the Americans and the Israelis to help him to spoil the election whenever they are decided. We have to wait and see if the Palestinian Authority is going to acknowledge the will of all the Palestinian groups and run the elections and allow for a free election among the Palestinian population. Because we already know the answer. Everywhere the Palestinian uprising is saying no to any agreement or security agreement with Israel that the Palestinian Authority is holding on to and collaborating with the Israelis. So when Haniyeh said that this is a historical moment, first of all, it's talking about Algeria, one of the countries that are holding the summit, which is a very good sign that there are other countries than the Gulf countries who are holding the Palestinian. And there is another country like Iran who's supporting the Palestinian cause, which is becoming rare today in the Arab world. Secondly, Haniyeh hopes to see the Palestinian Authority accepting to run a new election and Mahmoud Abbas to be removed from his position, because this is what he has been fighting for many years.
Thank you very much, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Fra Hughes, thank you, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, faithfulness to the promise and covenant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being faithfulness to the covenant and the promise in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Islam pays attention towards the faithfulness. It wants justice in the society. And one of the necessities of justice is that when we promise someone, when we have a covenant with someone, when we have a treaty with someone, we must be faithful to those covenants, to those promises, to those treaties. And this is very important that in Islam, we must take care of all things. Because if I am not faithful to the promise that I made to someone, to the covenant that I made with someone, if I'm not faithful with that, then obviously I cannot apply justice in the society. Therefore, when we talk about the justice in the society as a main theme, which has been brought by Islam, and Islam focuses on the justice, therefore it is necessary to be faithful to the promise that I have made. And this brings the humanity a level up. It brings the society a level up. In the society where people are faithful to their promises, where people are faithful to their covenant, the others can trust on them. It increases the trust of the people. It increases the nobility of the people. That when such people have made a promise and they are faithful to that, then obviously everyone can rely, they can trust. And this is important, and this is what the prophets used to teach and used to preach amongst the nations. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being faithful to the promise and covenant in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that when a person is not faithful to the promise that he has made, generally the public, they think that he has done something bad. And he has committed something which he should not be committing, or maybe he has performed a kind of injustice. And therefore, we think that this is a bad deed, this is a bad action, that when you have promised someone, you should be faithful, you should fulfill the promise that you have made. On the other hand, if there is a person who basically fulfills the promise that he has made, we trust him and we like such people. Therefore, even when we are talking about the relation of the parents and the kids, you know, sometimes when the kids are making noise, sometimes we promise them and we say them that if you do not make a noise, then, for example, I will buy an ice cream for you, I will give you such a gift, or maybe a sweet or a toffee or chocolate or something like that. But later, when we do not give them, when we do not fulfill our promise to our kids, the next time, even our kids, they don't trust us. And in reply, they say that last time you said so, but you never gave us, you never fulfilled your promise. Therefore, Islam, even in the family life, in the social life, in relation between the father or mother, or maybe like the kids or the grandparents or the family, the relations in the society, for example, with the neighbors, with the society, the work, in every single aspect of the life, Islam says us to be faithful, to remain faithful with the promise that we made so that the trust is being made amongst the people. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
if you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdul Latif Lwashali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough questions. You'd expect that. I mean, it's quite right that people, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalized this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organizations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically, it made no sense politically, and basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Bourizab, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process and were cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open 3 schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats. One of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rubeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rubeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The 4 Geneva Conventions, especially the 3rd Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Italia Sovrana Popolare chiede.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself. So we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In the limelight.
A dark cold winter awaits Britain with strikes and chaos in major city centres as the new Prime Minister Liz Truss is unable to rein in the economic crisis. Even experts have warned that Truss is about to collapse under the dead weights of the British economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Road, British Prime Minister Liz Truss's shoulders are too fragile to carry the weight of a sagging British economy. The pound sterling is sinking vis-à-vis the US dollar and may fall even lower against the greenback. Truss, however, is the architect of her own misfortune. Raw ambition blinded her to the reality that Britain is not only sick, but on its deathbed. Within a month of becoming Prime Minister, and after a grueling leadership contest in which she scrapped past Rishi Sunak, the Indian origin, wunderkind of finance, reality has caught up with her. Truss does not have the competence to turn the British economy around. Being a female does not give her any advantage either. Truss dumped her finance minister Kwasi Kwarteng on October 14th, even though he followed her advice on cutting taxes to revive the economy. She essentially shifted blame for her policy to the ousted finance minister. In his resignation letter, Kwarteng said Britain faces an incredibly difficult situation and following the status quo was not an option. As I have said many times in the past weeks, following the status quo was simply not an option, he wrote. For too long, this country has been dogged by low growth rates and high taxation. That must still change if this country is to succeed. While Britain has been sliding into economic oblivion, it has been hastened by the sanctions imposed on Russia. Two of Britain's leading newspapers coming from the right and left, the Sunday Telegraph and the Guardian, gave similar prognosis for what ails Britain. Sanctions against Russia have led to rising prices, especially fuel price. Soon after the crisis in Eastern Europe on February 24th, and the West imposed sanctions on Russia, The Guardian wrote, the shock waves from the Russia-Ukraine crisis will cut UK living standards by £2,500 per household, lead to more persistent inflationary pressure, and slow the economy to a standstill next year, economists fear. Market confidence has crashed, and with the pound sterling in free fall, the Bank of England has had to intervene to raise interest rates faster than planned. This has caused a surge in mortgage rates, causing more pain for ordinary people. The British economy is held hostage to the interest of international bankers and investment managers. They insist on their interest being protected. They do not care what happens to the people. Most people's standard of living has fallen drastically. It has been underway for decades, but recent developments have hastened the fall. There is talk of a palace coup to replace Truss with Rishi Sunak. Will he be able to rescue Britain's economy? It seems highly unlikely. There are deep structural problems in the British economy. Discontent is bound to spill over into the streets and may even lead to violence. A dark, cold winter awaits Britain, as indeed in much of Europe, that will be punctuated by strikes and chaos in major urban centres. Welcome to Britain's status as a third world country. This is the price of following Uncle Sam, who is prepared to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. The price for this folly has to be paid by the Europeans while the US sits safely across the pond. According to the website of Euractiv,
UK Prime Minister Liz Truss's month-old government is on the brink of collapse after she engineered another humiliating U-turn on planned tax cuts and sacked her finance minister, who was responsible for the proposals. On Friday, October 14th, Truss sacked Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng himself, only in post for 38 days, and his deputy Chris Philip was also moved out of the Treasury. Former Health and Foreign Affairs Minister Jeremy Hunt, who served in former